storefronts for instructors to hide in and pop out of. About three-quarters of the way down the street, I began to wonder if the instructors had forgotten about me, something that I mistakenly did as an instructor when the roles were reversed years later, as nothing happened. But no such luck. As multiple attackers in dark blue Secret Service-issued battle-dress uniforms appeared in the street, I immediately sought cover. The Op 4 had waited to attack because, as I walked farther and farther down the street, all of the quality cover to hide behind had disappeared. Cover is the tactical term for a relatively bullet-resistant object that you can hide behind for protection, such as a car or a wall. Concealment is another option that may or may not provide bullet-resistant cover, but does conceal you from the line of sight of the Op 4. For example, a thin piece of pipe and drape. The only cover available was a small fire hydrant. But when training in a simulation gunfight scenario, you take whatever cover you can get to avoid being pelted with endless simulation rounds. I was approximately 185 pounds at the time, and I'm 6 feet tall. But after being pelted by about 4 or 5 rock-hard simulation rounds, in all of the wrong places, yes, use your imagination, I squeezed my body behind that small fire hydrant and fired back. I even hit a few of the Op 4 instructors and managed to get them to move back before the exercise ended. This kind of repeated tactical training, where there is a real penalty for using poor tactics, being struck by a painful simulation round, is the only effective way to train the agent trainees of the Secret Service to respond to the inevitable tactical assault that awaits them in the future. Try to imagine a continuum of stress in a Secret Service emergency where a level 3 stress scenario is a lone gunman with a handgun, caught hundreds of yards away from the president before he fires his weapon. Then imagine a level 10 stress scenario on the stress continuum being a 50-man assault team firing high-powered automatic rifles with body armor-penetrating rounds, and men and women being brutally mowed down all around you as you struggle to gather your senses in order to locate and evacuate the president. The training scenario where I sought cover behind the small fire hydrant was a 1 or 2 on that stress continuum. But even at that low level of training-induced stress, you quickly learn to respect what level 10 would feel like. During the scenario, I vividly remember imagining how horrible the situation would have been if the simulation rounds that were striking me in the arms and legs and other painful places were real bullets, not training rounds. This is the kind of mindset you must train yourself to live with if you expect to succeed in the Secret Service. You must put aside the dread of being on the business end of a terrorist's rifle and put the life of the president first, and all of your fears a distant second. And although that fear is subordinated in favor of action after a long period of tactical training, it never really disappears. That fear serves as a motivational tool that agents use to work long into the night on very little sleep to avoid staring at that business end of a terrorist's rifle in a tactical assault that some terrorist group somewhere in the world is planning right now. But does the management of both the Secret Service and the Department of Homeland Security have the collective will to battle political pressure and to modify the tactics and the training of the Secret Service in order to respond to the nightmare tactical assault that is undoubtedly coming? I know many of the working agents and first-line supervisors in the Secret Service, and many of them are asking the same question. First, let's analyze why the threat of a tactical assault on the president is growing and evolving. Terror groups such as ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and their affiliates have embraced suicide as a strategic weapon, and this dramatically complicates security planning for the Secret Service. Before the rapid growth of suicide attacks using small arms and explosives, the Secret Service would allocate security assets to areas where cover and concealment were available, and a viable escape route was available to the attacker. If an agent is securing a motorcade route for the president that's close to 10 miles long, it's virtually impossible to secure every square foot of the anticipated motorcade route. Therefore, when planning the assignment of local police officers and Secret Service agents along the route, a good agent assigns those assets to the most likely place from which a threat would originate. Before the use of suicide attacks, which obviously require no escape route, as a standard terrorist strategy, an agent could reasonably assume that forested areas, abandoned buildings with back doors, adjoining highways, and elevated platforms would be the most likely places from which an attack would initiate. An attacker would have the benefits of concealment, possibly cover, and a means to escape during the chaos in those types of environments. But the evolution of the terror threat has thrown that playbook into the garbage can. A growing number of these radicalized terrorists have no interest in cover or concealment. They're only interested in body counts and carnage. These killers have no need for a highway or access road escape route because many of them aren't looking to escape. They're looking to kill, and kill themselves in the process. If you watch the videos from the Charlie Hebdo terror attacks in Paris, you will see a clear example of this. The terrorists weren't hiding behind garbage dumpsters, seeking cover. They were spending most of their time exposed in the street, screaming terrorist propaganda, and they were in no rush to escape. And for an extended period of time, they didn't even appear to be looking to leave the scene of their attack. Their priorities were media attention, propaganda dissemination, and accumulating as large a body count as possible. Escape and evasion appeared to be an afterthought. The evolving threat of a tactical assault on the president that could originate almost anywhere, not simply from locations with an escape route, and with cover and concealment, will make future presidential visits to locations anywhere outside of the White House grounds difficult to secure with today's technology and protection models. There simply aren't enough police officers and Secret Service agents to secure every building and forested area on a motorcade route. But there is a way to begin to counter this evolving threat: quality pre-protection operation intelligence. The Secret Service maintains a number of field offices around the United States and around the world, even though the likelihood of a presidential visit to many of the small cities and remote towns these field offices cover is close to zero. The Secret Service maintains these field offices to conduct criminal investigations in their respective jurisdictions, but also to build and maintain critical working relationships with local law enforcement agencies. It is these local law enforcement agencies that are often the source of the most usable pre-attack intelligence, and they will likely remain so in the future as terrorists continue to attempt to infiltrate refugee populations from terror-ravaged countries. Refugee populations subsequently spread throughout the United States' less densely populated cities and towns. Note, the Secret Service doesn't produce intelligence because of its sensitive role and proximity to the world's leaders, but it does consume intelligence related to its protectees. But rather than law enforcement at the local and federal levels narrowing down and perfecting the art of intelligence gathering in communities where the threats to the United States and the president are originating, many of these agencies are retreating due to political pressure. Many law enforcement agencies, such as the NYPD, are under intense pressure from both national and local political leaders to avoid surveillance of places where practitioners of Islam congregate. These artificial and unnecessary limitations constrain our law enforcement officials from doing their jobs. Imagine a scenario where an NYPD organized crime detective assigned to the Russian organized crime squad is forbidden to surveil locations where Russians congregate. Does this sound ridiculous? That's because it is ridiculous, and it's dangerous. The Russian mob would quickly figure out that they are operating in a law enforcement vacuum and adjust their meetings and tactics to ensure that they plan their illicit activities in locations where law enforcement is forbidden to go. Note, just as surveillance of the Russian mob in no way implicates all Russians in organized crime, surveillance of suspect locations of radical Islamic activity in no way implicates all practitioners of the faith in the activities of a few radical terrorists. I wish I could tell you otherwise, but a tactical assault on the president is likely being planned right now. Terrorists seeking media attention for their heinous acts have long understood that a successful attack on the president of the United States is the ultimate prize. Either harming or killing the president provides terrorists with universal media attention, which assists them in establishing credibility among terror financiers and new recruits. But it also gives them an opportunity to directly strike at the political head of our government, causing chaos through the resulting national psychological trauma. And the growing use of suicide tactics as a component of the assault greatly expands the attack options of the terror strike team, because there isn't a need for cover or concealment, or the need for a viable escape route. The only way to react to a threat such as this is not to just react, but to be proactive via quality intelligence gathering and analysis, which will allow law enforcement and the Secret Service to intercept a planned tactical assault on the president before it happens. But even this necessary component of protection planning is being stifled by political pressure to provide extra justification for investigations involving threats from Islamic-inspired terror groups. Many of my law enforcement sources have told me that investigative leads are being left on the table and not properly investigated because of the pressure to provide unimpeachable, documented reasons for opening up terror investigations within Islamic communities. The fear of being labeled an Islamophobe by interest groups committed to using our legal system and public pressure to encourage law enforcement to look the other way keeps many potential terror investigations locked in a desk drawer. We've already seen the tragic outcomes of these known wolf terror attacks with Orlando nightclub terrorist Omar Mateen, Fort Hood terrorist Nidal Hassan, New York and New Jersey bomber Ahmad Rahami, and the most disturbing case of all, Anwar al-Awlaki. Awlaki was a vocal al-Qaeda cleric and terrorist recruiter who was interviewed multiple times by the FBI after the September 11, 2001 attacks. The FBI and the NYPD cannot break up a terror cell from a case trapped in a dusty file cabinet. And the Secret Service will never be able to proactively stop the presidential assassination it never hears about due to political pressure suffocating investigations before they can begin. Politics is impacting the Secret Service protective mission in other ways not immediately obvious to even the experienced observer. I spent most of my first year as a Secret Service agent providing protective advance work for Hillary Clinton during her U.S. Senate campaign. I was working in the Melville, Long Island office of the Secret Service at the time, and the office had a limited staff of agents. The small staff, combined with the frequent trips by Mrs. Clinton to both Nassau and Suffolk counties, the areas covered by the Melville office in Long Island, put me in frequent contact with Mrs. Clinton, her staff, and her PPD Secret Service agents. It was clear from the start of her U.S. Senate campaign that our lives in the Melville office were going to be made miserable by this campaign. As I stated earlier, one of the primary responsibilities of the Secret Service agents in the field is to maintain a strong working relationship with the local law enforcement officials for both investigative and protection purposes. The Secret Service relies heavily on these local law enforcement officials for both physical protection manpower on the outer and middle rings of protection and for the critical intelligence that largely local law enforcement has the contacts to develop in order to disrupt any potential attack on the president. Maintaining good relationships with local law enforcement was exceedingly difficult when dealing with the Hillary Clinton for U.S. Senate campaign, because Mrs. Clinton's staff would constantly complain about the visible presence of the local police at the sites she visited. I obviously couldn't read Hillary's mind at the time, but in my conversations with her staff, it appeared that they wanted the uniformed police officers hidden and tucked away to give Hillary the appearance of approachability. Approachability was the same reason given for the use of what we called the Scooby-Doo van. Mrs. Clinton shunned the use of the standard First Lady limousine package and used a ghastly-looking brown van for transportation instead, thinking that it made her appear more approachable. The political decision to keep the local police officers at a distance, and the decision to use the Scooby-Doo van, was a nightmare for the Secret Service agents in the Melville office. First, the use of a stock van built for family travel, not tactical efficiency, caused enormous headaches for the Secret Service armorers, who had to ensure that the vehicle met certain standards for bullet resistance. Additionally, the van was extremely difficult to operate in any tactical driving scenario because of its height and weight. If the van was fired at from multiple angles, it would be a challenge to rapidly speed off and navigate turns at high speeds. In short, the Secret Service management team should have shut the decision to use the van down early and negotiated a better solution. But politics and approachability got in the way. Second, the local police in Nassau and Suffolk counties, understandably, didn't take kindly to constantly being told to back off by the Clinton campaign staff. It became a recurring hassle trying to soothe hurt Clinton staff members' feelings whenever they would see a small cadre of uniformed police officers securing a road intersection near a site Hillary Clinton was scheduled to visit. Can you blame the local police management for being upset? They were hard-working career men and women who had spent their working lives policing their respective areas and creating both safety and security. No police officer or police manager wants to be known for letting an area descend into criminal chaos for both moral and professional reasons. But it didn't appear that the Clinton Senate campaign cared about any of this. If they saw uniformed police officers in areas they didn't approve of, and they thought the optics were bad, and that it made Mrs. Clinton look unapproachable, they would raise the issue with the Secret Service supervisor responsible for her protective shift, who would then bring the issue to my boss in the Melville office. Rather than focusing on securing the life of Mrs. Clinton, this charade caused us all to waste inordinate amounts of time, politely requesting that uniformed police officers move slightly to the left or slightly to the right, so that Mrs. Clinton couldn't see them. This back-and-forth dance with the police officers at these protected sites was a disgrace. The Secret Service works with local law enforcement to create a safe and secure scene for both the protectee and the people attending the protectee's event. Asking local police departments to hide themselves, like misbehaving children, in the corner of a classroom was humiliating for agents like me, who were police officers before joining the Secret Service. And, more important, it was humiliating to the hard-working cops, just doing their jobs and helping the Secret Service accomplish the mission. With the growth of phone, camera, and video technology, I expect this trend to grow worse in the future as Secret Service protectees, the president included, demand improved protection optics, and they empower their inexperienced staff members to insert themselves into and change the security plans, depending on how approachable they look. Never forget, terrorists planning a group tactical assault with heavy weapons and explosives are looking for approachable protectees too. Defending against an organized tactical assault on the president is an extraordinarily challenging task and is one of the Secret Service's essential protective responsibilities. How can the Secret Service be expected to design security plans to defeat a small team of terrorists with heavy weapons and explosives when the rings of security, which are heavily reliant on the support and manpower provided by local law enforcement, are compromised due to political concerns, not security concerns? The Secret Service managers I worked with understood the need to balance the accessibility needs of Secret Service protectees against the security needs of the protectee. But Secret Service upper management must resist the urge in the future to roll over under pressure from protectees and their staffs to dramatically alter security plans because they don't meet some hard-to-define political aspiration of approachability. I suspect some Secret Service managers went along with these ridiculous security requests because they wanted to be liked by Mrs. Clinton, and they wanted to avoid any career-damaging controversy, which the Clintons would have unquestionably caused for any member of the Secret Service standing in their way. The natural instinct to be liked by the protectee is a tough one to suppress. I fell victim to it at times, while assigned to Jenna Bush's detail. Jenna was always very friendly and easy to work with, but conflicts would inevitably develop, and it was tough to do the right thing, and not the easy thing, when you know the right thing is going to cause a fight with your protectee. Being around Mrs. Clinton constantly as a result of her travel schedule and campaigning probably caused some of the same conflicts with the Secret Service managers on her detail. I know many of the members of Hillary's PPD detail knew that the local cops were growing tired of the run-and-hide routine, but they would ask our Melville office team to make the request to move the police officers anyway. Mrs. Clinton had no issue airing her displeasure with things she didn't like, and I'm sure the PPD agents assigned to her wanted to avoid being lectured by her in the Scooby van after an unapproved police sighting. Also, a call from Mrs. Clinton to Secret Service headquarters would be very damaging to any Secret Service agent's career if that agent were the subject of that call. Mrs. Clinton's security arrangements, because of this recurrent conflict with the local police, became more of a lesson in conflict avoidance rather than physical security. It's a miracle nothing happened to her because of this. But due to the evolving threat of a tactical assault from committed terror groups, there are no guarantees in the future if protection becomes about the optics of approachability rather than sound protection tactics. Local law enforcement, in uniform or not, are a Secret Service agent's best friend, and they are their first line of defense against the ever-present threat of a tactical assault. Secret Service management, in the future, is going to have to resist the urge to allow protectees such as Hillary Clinton the opportunity to treat them as political pawns to be shuffled around as they see fit, while compromising both their safety and that of the Secret Service. The evolving threat of a tactical assault is compounded by the threat presented by evolving weapons technology. The detection of weapons is a mainstay of Secret Service security planning, and the use of advanced non-metallic materials for weapons construction may render much of their current technology useless in the future. Three-dimensional printing technology and the evolution of advanced polymers will make it possible in the near future to construct deadly weapons in the comfort of your own home or business, and this technology has the potential to render the government regulation of firearms nearly impotent. In the future, polymer-based firearms, built using a home-based 3D printer, will be easy to construct, and will be limited only by access to the software codes necessary to build these weapons. The Secret Service relies heavily on the use of magnetometers to detect weapons, but this dated technology relies on the presence of metal to function. Although technology currently exists and is in use in many of our airports that uses body scanning rather than metal detection, the Secret Service is going to have to overcome its tendency toward bureaucratic inertia to move toward an agency-wide overhaul of its current magnetometer-centric security planning. Better weapons detection through advanced screening mechanisms using technology that already exists, a rededication to cooperative intelligence sharing with both federal and local law enforcement partners, a strong Secret Service management culture that fights back against protectees who politicize security, and the continued evolution of the Secret Service training program to ensure its agents are regularly exposed to the stresses of simulated combat in a tactical assault are all steps the Secret Service can take today to ensure the threat of a catastrophic tactical assault on the president remains just that, a threat, and not a reality. Chapter 5. The Threat of a Presidential Medical Emergency. Having an arsenal of firearms and impact weapons capable of handling everything from an unusual interest case, that guy who refuses to let go of the president's hand while shaking it on a rope line, to a terrorist hit team with belt-fed automatic weapons, is critical to both discouraging and countering an attack on the president. but it's only a small piece of the presidential protection puzzle. We live in the real world, and in that real world, the everyday threats the Secret Service encounters are more likely to come from a medical emergency involving the president than they are from a tactical assault by terrorists. I was both a student and an instructor at the Secret Service Training Academy, and a significant portion of the special agent training program is spent learning how to deal with a presidential medical crisis. The agents are trained to be skilled first responders, because the advanced medical care, if necessary, in a medical emergency, will be provided by military medical assets traveling with the president on every trip. The Secret Service's training program trains their agents to effectively, and under intense stress, stop bleeding from an open wound, stabilize a broken bone, stabilize the head and neck, deliver oxygen, and take other immediate emergency medical actions in the moments just after a medical crisis. The Secret Service repeatedly drills their agents and trainees on easy-to-recall emergency response medical actions during their training programs, because agents will likely use their emergency medical response training only in scenarios where the fight-or-flight physiological response has taken over. Place yourself in the shoes of a senior Secret Service agent standing in front of the presidential podium as the president is delivering a speech to thousands of people in an arena, and millions more on television. I've been there, and it's a surreal feeling that encourages temporary attention lapses as you notice the unusual behaviors and mesmerized stares of people seeing the president for the first time. As an agent on the presidential detail, you have to be hyper-attentive to your surroundings and the condition of the president at all times. There is no room for daydreaming on the PPD. But when you're standing in front of the Klieg lights with the leader of the free world, it's exceedingly difficult to maintain 100% focus. I was always fighting the urge to mentally wander off to what my daughter was doing at school, or why that man in the third row of the speech location is wearing that awful lime green sweater to a presidential speech. Secret Service agents are human beings, too, and as their careers progress, they learn, as I did, to drown the noise out and to pay attention to the details that matter, such as inappropriate crowd behavior and hidden hands. But no amount of training can teach an agent to act like a robot. If the president were to collapse on stage during a speech, the Secret Service agents surrounding him would immediately respond. But there's little doubt that temporary chaos would ensue. Media figures would be trying to report the breaking news while their camera operators and photographers would be trying to get the best shot of the fallen president. The crowd would quickly grow concerned and would need to be controlled to avoid a stampede. The White House staff would respond to the stage, desperate to control the ensuing narrative and to protect the president's image. And all of this would create an environment of unimaginable physiological stress for the first Secret Service agent to arrive at the president's side. But that agent must control his emotions and act, because the moments immediately following a serious medical crisis can be the difference between life and premature death. In the critical early moments of a medical emergency, it is absolutely essential that certain steps be followed, and to ensure those steps are followed, the Secret Service trains their agents to look, listen, and feel. This is familiar to any emergency responder, and it's a quick way to remember to look for the chest rising and falling, to listen for breathing at the mouth and nose, and to feel for a pulse. It is these easy-to-remember bullet points that enable agents under stress to easily recall their training without having to engage in higher-order mental gymnastics, which can be lost while responding to a medical emergency under stress. But there was another training tip I learned as an agent trainee in the Secret Service Academy that I worry will never apply to the Secret Service again after the events surrounding Hillary Clinton on September 11, 2016. Check, call, and care. There are few areas as uncontroversial in the security field as the appropriate response to a medical emergency. But the Clintons have a penchant for politicizing everything they touch, and the Secret Service response to a medical emergency may never be the same after Hillary Clinton's medical episode on September 11, 2016. During a memorial ceremony commemorating the victims of the September 11, 2001 terror attacks, which I described earlier in the book, and which Mrs. Clinton attended, she left the event earlier than her scheduled departure. Mrs. Clinton's early departure elicited some attention from the media representatives on the scene, because there had been some earlier media speculation about her fitness to be the President of the United States, based on scattered reports of poor health. As a video later showed, Mrs. Clinton appeared to lose consciousness temporarily as her Secret Service detail escorted her into an awaiting van. I was taught in Secret Service training that during a medical emergency involving the loss of consciousness of a protectee, we should check, call, and care. Check the scene for danger, call 911, and care for the protectee. These steps are modifiable depending on the severity of the medical emergency. But after reviewing the tape of Hillary Clinton nearly collapsing while attempting to enter her Secret Service van on September 11th, 2016, I'm convinced politics took precedence over her health during the incident. Unfortunately, the Clintons appear incapable of separating any decision they make, about their health or otherwise, from the resulting political ramifications. They have spent their entire lives in the political arena, and they have learned to consider each decision not on its moral, ethical, or health merits, but on the resulting political capital to be gained or lost by that decision. I have little doubt that the agents working on Hillary Clinton's detail on the day she nearly collapsed at the September 11th memorial ceremony wanted to take her to a hospital for evaluation. But in the heat of a contentious political campaign, where questions about her health continued to surface, the pressure from the campaign staff appeared to have won out. As stated in Chapter 3, Hillary Clinton didn't go to the hospital after her health episode that day. Instead, she retreated to her daughter's apartment, where the campaign staff and the political voices around her could focus on handling the narrative they wanted to spin about her health, rather than ensuring that she wasn't in the midst of a severe health crisis. Thankfully, Hillary reappeared later in the day in front of an eager outpost of media representatives, anxiously staged in front of her daughter's apartment, and appeared to be fine, but it didn't have to turn out that way. If her health had taken a turn for the worse, the agents assigned to her that day would have been ruthlessly second-guessed for their actions, and the political decision-makers who may have had a role in her avoiding the hospital would have likely faded back into obscurity, avoiding any blame whatsoever. It's precisely these types of pressures in this new era of 24-hour-a-day news coverage, ubiquitous cell phone cameras, and social media postings that the Secret Service is going to have to deal with in the future. Secret Service management, as with the pushback they've received from the Clinton camp and others on the optics of uniformed police officers at Secret Service secured sites, must be prepared for pushback in the future when a protectee medical crisis demands that they respond in a manner suited to save the life of the protectee, not to spin a media narrative. It's not the Secret Service's job to ensure that in the tragic event that the President faints and hits his head on the ground, the people surrounding him don't use their phones to take a video of the event. These videos may be embarrassing on the evening news, but the videos won't kill the President. The lack of medical attention in a medical crisis, due to political concerns over health concerns, will. Chapter 6. The threat to the President from chemical, biological attacks and explosives. Assassinations, assassination attempts, and warfare through poisoning, chemical, and biological attacks have been used primarily by states or state-sponsored actors. The 2017 assassination of Kim Jong-nam, the estranged half-brother of North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, using a nerve agent, the 1988 chemical gas attack on the Kurds by the Iraqi military, which killed thousands, and the 2013 and 2017 gas attacks on Syrian civilians by the Syrian army, are recent examples of state-sponsored chemical attacks. Another was the near-lethal poisoning of former Ukrainian President Viktor Yushchenko, which was likely carried out by state-sponsored actors. And although these tactics aren't completely foreign to terror syndicates and small group actors, as we saw with the 1995 sarin gas attack in the Japanese subway system by the group Aum Shinrikyo, and smaller chemical attacks in the Middle East by known terror groups, these types of attacks are exceedingly difficult to pull off without the backing of state actors. Despite the ready availability of preparatory information on the Internet, these deadly chemicals and biological agents are extremely challenging to prepare and store without eliciting the attention of law enforcement officials. Once prepared, many of these chemical and biological agents also require a delivery mechanism to disperse them among the intended victims. A growing problem for the Secret Service with regard to the chemical biological weapons threat is detection. The bureaucratic inertia of the Secret Service often prevents the agency from responding proactively to growing threats. But this threat is uniquely dangerous, and the agency must respond as such. Given the grave danger of this threat to the President and to Secret Service protectees, I must be cautious in this chapter not to divulge any operational details that would put our agents at risk. With that caveat stated, the Secret Service does extensive planning to prevent losing a protectee to a chemical biological attack. The Secret Service has a special team dedicated exclusively to the decontamination of the President and his immediate protective detail, but decontamination is far different from detection. The Secret Service should prioritize the training of their hazardous agent detection teams, and they should immediately recruit from the military and scientific communities the best chemical biological weapons experts they can find, and use them to train for attacks using these chemical biological agents. It is only through the repetition, under stress of a simulated attack training stimulus, that the Secret Service personnel assigned to the hazardous materials teams will uncover the holes in their detection, decontamination, and evacuation plan. The use of chemical biological weapons presents a number of additional complications for the Secret Service outside of the physiological complications from such an attack. For example, are there extra clothes around to cover the decontaminated personnel after the immediate attack? Clothes would be immediately stripped off, and as I discussed in the last chapter, the political figures surrounding the President would be understandably concerned about the optics of a semi-nude President being decontaminated or dragged from an attack site. Do not underestimate the power of political optics and the pressure constantly put on the Secret Service to do things that make their protectees look good, rather than taking actions that make them safe and secure. I'm concerned that in a questionable chemical biological attack scenario, one where a suspicious powder is found on or near a protectee, but its status as a weapon isn't confirmed, the growing pressure on the Secret Service to engage in a political response rather than a decontamination response will be overwhelming and potentially deadly. The hazardous agent teams in the Secret Service must be assured of the support of Secret Service management in the unfortunate event that they must take action in a questionable scenario, such as the one I just described. Sadly, when I was an agent, I heard from agents often on the PPD and in the uniformed division at the White House who feared acting out of precaution and then being thrown under the bus by Secret Service managers. It's tragic that with a pressing threat such as the one from chemical biological agents, that the concern of many of the Secret Service personnel would be support by management. But it was very real when I was on the PPD. The threat to the President from the tactical use of explosives is another evolving threat that keeps many Secret Service agents up at night. The recent wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan have been instructive for U.S. military personnel. They have learned how to respond to the evolving tactics of our enemies. But those wars have also been instructive for our enemies, who are learning to evolve to our technology as well. Our enemies are learning how to modify explosives into explosively formed penetrators, EFPs, which are shaped to penetrate the armored vehicles our military use in the war zone to transport personnel. Many of these EFP attacks have been lethal in the war zones, and they led to the military's development of newer transportation platforms, such as mine-resistant, ambush-protected MRAP vehicles with V-shaped bottom halves to disperse the blast pressure from improvised explosive devices, or IEDs. This is an area where the Secret Service has done a superb job. They are so concerned, appropriately so, about the threat from an EFP or an improvised explosive device attack on their armored vehicles that they are constantly working with both private industry and entities within the U.S. government and military to improve their vehicle armoring technology. The Secret Service has a full-time crew of personnel exclusively dedicated to winning the dangerous explosives versus armor technology race. And their approach to armor technology is evidence of the agency's ability to do things correctly when the management puts aside politics and personal ambition to fix a problem. Chapter 7. The Growing Threat to the President from the Skies. When I joined the Secret Service in 1999, the threat of a potential attack on the president from the skies was expected to originate from small planes and helicopters. After the September 11, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, that threat analysis changed. Although Secret Service security advances had considered the threat of an airborne assault from the skies using a hijacked jetliner in the years before the September 11th attacks, the gravity of the threat became tragically transparent after the September 11th attacks occurred. Ironically, as the airborne threat evolves, the primary threat to the president has morphed from the passenger jets used in the September 11th attacks to small, miniature, and micro-sized drones. Drones present a number of security complications for the Secret Service. A small, commercially available modern drone can be used as a delivery mechanism to carry and drop an explosive device on the secure grounds of the White House, causing both damage and chaos, a method already being used by terrorist organizations against U.S. forces on foreign battlefields. Or a micro-drone, the size of an insect, could be flown into the White House complex and used as a nearly undetectable surveillance tool. A miniature unarmed drone can also be used to tie up limited Secret Service surveillance, uniformed officer and agent assets, while a secondary assault takes place elsewhere on the White House complex. The threat of distraction, while a secondary assault takes place, taking advantage of the protection assets bogged down with the distraction, is nothing new to the Secret Service. But a distraction from the sky using a drone is a new type of threat. When I was an instructor in the Secret Service Training Academy, we used a training scenario for protection exercises where trained role players and training staff would pretend to be members of a crowd on a presidential rope line. The role players would pretend to fight at one end of the rope line, while a mock assassin would fire his training weapon at the person playing the role of the president from the other end of the rope line. New agent trainees frequently got baited into the distraction and would miss the real threat from the assassin at the other end of the rope line. But seasoned agents returning to the training academy for in-service training rarely fell for this same stunt. Distractions from the sky, whether planes or drones, create additional security complications for an obvious reason. Secret Service agents and officers cannot fly. Investigating a ground-based threat, such as an alarm break on the White House grounds, is usually as simple as an agent or uniformed division officer walking over to the area where the alarm was tripped and clearing it, or apprehending a suspect. The overwhelming majority of the time, these alarm notifications are wildlife walking across the White House grounds at night and are quickly cleared, creating a minor distraction for the White House protection personnel involved. But airborne alarms create a multitude of security headaches, because they require some technological intervention to clear the alarm or take down the drone. Drones have to be either physically removed from the secure skies over the White House by physically intercepting the drone, or by intercepting the drone's communications from the drone operator. The drone threat is further complicated by rapidly advancing drone technology, which allows the drone to be flown automatically, without guidance and communications from an operator. In this complicated case, the Secret Service should monitor the ongoing development of a new class of military lasers that can overload the electronics of a flying drone, destroying its capability to stay airborne. Disrupting the communications of the drone can allow the security personnel at the White House to land the drone and investigate if it is weaponized, being used for surveillance, or just a nuisance. All of these interventions require time and technology, and they present the Secret Service with a number of complications if the drones infiltrate the secure White House airspace in swarms. As I stated in the introduction, I know many of you reading this may be wondering, why give the bad guys any ideas? That's a fair question. But I can relay to you with certainty that the ideas have been floating around among groups with ill intent for a long time. I wrote this book precisely because I am genuinely concerned that some of these sclerotic Secret Service upper management who are entrenched and who refuse to evolve with the evolving threat environment will not acknowledge the seriousness of this threat and boldly respond to it. I'm also convinced that Secret Service management may avoid the necessary major security overhauls that must happen at the White House until enough public pressure is put on them to respond. Many of the Secret Service managers making the critical decisions about the safety of the life of the President of the United States are career risk managers. They've learned to manage the risks to their own careers by not rocking the proverbial boat. Many of these upper management personnel are just years from retirement and are looking at high six-figure post-retirement jobs in the consulting or security services fields. They are not looking for a fight over a dramatic shift in the Secret Service security plan at the White House. They'll enact some token security measure to take a few drones down on the White House grounds, but they likely understand that the real threat comes from the more spectacular swarm attacks. And I'm concerned that they're doing little to defend against this very real threat. Here's a real-life example of the managerial risk avoidance I referenced within the Secret Service. When I was assigned to the transportation section of the Presidential Protective Division, located in Secret Service headquarters, I was asked by my direct supervisor to attend a meeting with a representative from a security company. The company had developed a secure satellite technology applicable toward monitoring the whereabouts of President Bush when he was riding his bike. GPS technology wasn't nearly as advanced at the time as it is currently. Although President Bush always rode with a peloton of staff, military and Secret Service agents, he would at times veer far off course into the woods, and we would lose sight of him from the road when we were stationed in the motorcade. This was always a source of distress because if during those critical moments where we lost visual contact with the president from the cars, a Secret Service supervisor called out for his location on the radio, the agents in the cars wouldn't have a specific answer, and every agent listening to the back-and-forth radio traffic knew it. During the opening moments of the meeting, the representative from the security company began to describe what I felt was an elegant solution to this problem using his company's secure GPS technology. But not a few minutes into the presentation, the agent in charge of the division overseeing these types of acquisitions rudely interrupted him and shut down the meeting, saying the technology wouldn't work. I was embarrassed for him. The security representative had hauled his butt out to our headquarters, and he had a perfectly viable technology, solving a vexing security problem for the Secret Service, and he wasn't even allowed to finish his introduction before being shown the door. This was not an isolated incident, as similar situations happened when I was assigned to the Secret Service Training Center Operations section. I recall two companies that were looking to make their technology available to us, and also being preemptively shown the door. One company had a fire suppression chemical, which I thought was a good fit for the Secret Service advance teams working on overseas trips where the fire department was either non-existent or ill-prepared to handle a fire. The second product was a weapons system that allowed the operator to fire his weapon from around a corner, giving the operator a tremendous tactical advantage in a firefight. But neither of these products got a fair look because the company representatives never got past the email and introduction stage. I saw this over and over again at the Secret Service, and it was events such as this that led the agents I worked with to mock the Secret Service's fear of new technology by saying the motto of the agency should be, "The Secret Service, yesterday's technology, tomorrow." But as we saw with the proactive Secret Service effort to work with both the private sector and the military on armor technology for the Secret Service vehicle fleet, the management is capable of evolving with the current threats when they perceive the threat as either immediate enough or catastrophic enough. Walk into many technology company corporate headquarters, and you'll see pieces of their technological security puzzle and their access control mechanisms putting the Secret Service's technology to shame. These companies have an incentive to control access to their facilities to avoid the theft of their technology, and many of them will spare no expense on retinal scanning, fingerprint access systems, and other modern access control technologies. But the Secret Service operates differently. Many of their critical decision makers and management fear the impact on their careers if they propose a solution for a spectacular attack, such as a drone swarm strike, because that attack is unlikely to happen on their watch. And they refuse to burn an ounce of their internal career capital, which many intend to use on promotions and on relationships with the private sector they plan to join in retirement. On changing a security plan that hasn't, in modern times, resulted in the loss of a president. Yet. But if the White House security plan doesn't evolve and doesn't leverage technology to its advantage, then it will fail. It's solely a matter of when. The Secret Service must regularly consult with an outside consortium of technology leaders, military operators, and industry security leaders to consult on both its use of technology and on an upgrade of the airborne security blanket surrounding the White House. They must develop and continuously improve an impenetrable air defense, prepared to handle an infiltration of tens or hundreds of drones at a time. Mass interception of the drones' communications, along with physical interception of the drones, must be foolproof and immediate. And the detection technology for the drones must empower on-site Secret Service leadership at the White House to make immediate decisions on both interception and disruption. When an attack such as this happens, there isn't going to be time to make multiple phone calls to Secret Service headquarters staff or to PPD management to defeat the drones. The PPD special agents and uniformed division officers on duty at the White House have to be empowered to train with, be able to operate, and immediately use the anti-drone technology, or they will be quickly overrun, like a schoolyard by a swarm of wasps. Chapter 8. Trump and Twitter. A blessing and a curse. The Trump presidential campaign used, and the Trump presidency continues to use, social media platforms such as Twitter in a manner never seen before in presidential politics. Although I've never run for the presidency, I have run for the United States Senate and the House of Representatives, and I'm familiar with the political consultant class and many of their robotic recommendations for candidates with regard to social media usage. Pre-Donald Trump, the generally accepted theory among the political consultants I spoke with regarding social media resembled the Hippocratic Oath: do no harm. In other words, use your social media accounts to post innocuous, non-confrontational political messages targeted toward a specific voter demographic and, critically, avoid unnecessary social media fights at all costs. Many of the political consultants and campaign managers I know do not even allow their political clients access to their own social media accounts out of fear that they may do harm. The consultants insist on controlling the accounts as a preventative firewall in the event a candidate has an original thought and decides to post it to Twitter before a focus group testing the tweet. The Trump presidential campaign broke both of these rules. Trump frequently fought with his political opponents on Twitter, and the more prominent the opponent, the more likely he was to get a spirited response. In addition, Trump's Twitter feed, although monitored by his campaign staff, clearly was his personal vehicle for many stream-of-consciousness tweets. I have first-hand experience with Donald Trump and his creative use of Twitter, because I was the subject of one of his tweets during the tail end of the 2016 presidential campaign. On August 9, 2016, I received a call from a booker at CNN asking me to appear that night on Don Lemon's nightly program. I was knee-deep in my own campaign for Congress in Florida's 19th congressional district at the time, and was hesitant to agree to the appearance. But as is often the case with gut feelings, something told me to do it. The booker, due to my Secret Service background, wanted me to comment on statements Donald Trump had made with regard to Second Amendment supporters and Hillary Clinton, which some in the cable news talking head class had disingenuously portrayed as a threat to Hillary. The appearance quickly degenerated into a slugfest between me and the host, Don Lemon, as I defended Trump's comments, adding that, in my professional opinion, this was nothing remotely resembling a threat. At one point, after being repeatedly talked over, I shouted at Lemon, "You don't know crap, Don." I said this because it is true. He doesn't. Lemon was never a Secret Service agent, and he has zero experience in the threat assessment arena. But I do. I was frustrated that he insisted on telling me how threat analysis worked, despite never having done it. This happens often with left-leaning media figures who outrageously assume that their faces on television anoint them with special insight into issues that actual experts don't have. I'm not sure if Donald Trump was watching my appearance on CNN at the time, but he either saw it or someone told him about it after the fact. The next morning, a little after 11 o'clock, I glanced at the Twitter app on my mobile phone and noticed something odd. I had picked up a couple hundred new Twitter followers. Picking up a few hundred followers in a week was a social media milestone for me, so you can imagine my surprise to see a spike of a few hundred followers in just a few minutes. When I opened the app, I found out why the new burst of followers. Donald Trump had tweeted to me, thanking me for defending him on the CNN appearance. His tweet read, "At D. Bongino, you were fantastic in defending both the Second Amendment and me last night on at CNN. Don Lemon is a lightweight, dumb as a rock." I appreciated the gratitude, and by the end of the day, I had accumulated thousands of new Twitter followers. But not everyone appreciates the tweets of Donald Trump, as I did. This is where the Secret Service enters the equation and must evolve to the changing social media environment. The Secret Service has personnel assigned to their headquarters whose sole responsibility is to monitor and track presidential threats on the Internet and on social media platforms. When I joined the Secret Service in 1999, as email was beginning to crowd out snail mail as the primary means of written communication, I remember conversing with protective intelligence agents and lamenting the fact that written presidential threats had just overcome a major obstacle. The stamp. The small obstacles of paying for a stamp and physically writing out a threat letter using a pen and paper were now eliminated, and anyone in front of a computer could email a threat to the White House email address. We all knew this was going to lead to an avalanche of new threats to be investigated. The explosive growth of social media platforms such as Facebook and Twitter eliminated yet another small obstacle to communicating a presidential threat, the need to search for a White House email address. As I proposed in my 2013 book, Life Inside the Bubble, I believe these factors were the primary drivers for the growth in the number of reported threat cases directed at President Barack Obama. Many in the media attempted to link the growth in threat cases to racism against President Obama, but I didn't notice any sudden surge in racism while I was on President Obama's personal protection detail. I did, however, notice an explosion in social media usage while Obama was the president, And with that increased social media usage came the ability to threaten the President of the United States by simply tweeting to him or tagging him on Facebook, a process that requires little effort. And based